Station number 21191, Reel 2.
Bob Craig, Reel 2.
Right. So I went down below, and it was in darkness, of course, but there's just secondary lighting. That they are battery-operated lamps that come on when the main power, they're operated by a magnet. When the power's on, the magnet doesn't work. But when the power goes off, the magnet comes up and the battery operates the lamp. So you've got battery-operated secondary lighting. Just weak lighting. The officer of the watch was standing on by the throttle, and I had all the gauges and so on. Look, we had a full head of steam, but the telegraphs were showing full ahead, but the engines were stopped. I thought, well, I didn't know that the telegraphs were broken, of course. Nobody knew. At least they couldn't know. So I asked, what's happening? Nobody answered me. The senior engineer who'd come below for action, I presume, I went across to him and said, what's happening? And he turned and looked to me and went up the ladder. He was ready to fake out. So I thought, well, nothing was moving, no power on, nothing was going. And then somebody shouted down the ladder, abandon engine rooms. So I sent the stoker up to confirm that this was in fact an order, abandoned engine rooms. And he shouted, yes it is. So I informed the afternoon room with my voice pipe, because having no power, we had no telephones. Didn't have sound powered phones in those days, not at that time. But we had a voice pipe between the two engine rooms. So I told the afternoon room to abandon the engine room, and said to the stoker, up you go. I turned to the officer of the watch, who was still at the throttle, and I said, come on, what are you going to do? And he just passed out. One just flaming hot down there. It was really red hot. It was steaming hot. You couldn't touch the ladder as you went up or down. You had to put your elbows on and go up that way. Anyway, he just passed out, and so I said to the last stoker who got, I said, get a Neil Robinson stretcher so I can haul him up. Well, he went up and I sat on the plates holding this officer of the watch up so he gets some air for about 10 minutes. It seemed longer, but I think it was only about 10 minutes. And down came the stoker again with a hammock lashing, a rope. I said, that's no good. But he said, well, we'll try and get him up. So we put it over his head, under his arms, and tried to haul him up, but you couldn't possibly. The stoker went up the ladder pulling, and I was underneath pushing, but you couldn't touch the ladder because it was red hot. We couldn't get him up. So I said, set him down again. I said, go and get a Neil Robinson stretcher, we can pull him up in that. You know what a Neil Robinson stretcher is? It's the fire brigade use them nowadays a bit. It's a bamboo stretcher that straps all round you, and you can haul the whole thing up. Anyway, we waited again, and nobody came down for another 5 or 10 minutes. And eventually, another chief ERA came down, and he brought another rope. And we tied the two ropes together under his arms, and the chief ERA went up the ladder and pulled from up top. We pulled this officer of the watch up, and he died that night. He never recovered. But eventually I went up and flaked out for about 5 or 10 minutes on the deck. And then I said, well, we're stopped. What we're going to do? We're stopped in the middle of the Indian Ocean. We can't stop here. There was no sign of any injured officer. So I raked around and got an engine room crew, fore and after engine room crews, and sent them down to raise steam again. Somebody had to do something about it because we can't just stop there. And we raised steam, got some fair amount of vacuum back, and so, And when it was ready, I thought, well, still no engineer officers anywhere. So I went up to the bridge to report to the captain that we were engines were ready to move now. And the engineer commander was up there all the time. He'd been up there all the time. He'd never been anywhere else. He looked to me, because I was wet through with sweat, of course, and unkempt, and really, you know. He looked at me most disapprovingly for going on the bridge to the captain and saluting and saying engine's ready. That was the engineer commander's job to report engine's ready. And he came down the engine room and tried main engines with me, as though we were just leaving harbour. Anyway, we got underway, picked up survivors from the Germans, but that was 2 hours gap. There was a 2 hour gap between when she sank and when we picked the first survivors up. Which we lost 2 hours. Well, that was all this happened in 2 hours. But I was never asked to explain what had happened. Nobody questioned what I'd done. Nobody thanked me for what I'd done. It just passed off, and that was it.
And you never wrote a report on it?
No. Well, it wasn't up to me to write a report. It was up to the city engineer. We never saw him. But there you are. That was what we got underway and picked up survivors. We picked up, I think, 29 English survivors, prisoners, and I think about 70 Germans.
What condition were they all in?
Oily. But they've been, you know, like any survivors, you get covered in oil. That's it. But I don't think any of them were badly wounded. If they had been wounded, they died in the water anyway, I expect. But that's the, we steamed in. Of course, we had a big hole up forward, and a hole in the chief bureau's pantry. We steamed into Mauritius, and repaired ourselves. Put patched over the side, listed the ship, patched the side. Enough to make it watertight, and we had no engine room telegraphs. Of course, we had to pass orders down by word of mouth by a chain of people until they got the power. Once we got telephones going, we used telephone orders from the bridge by telephone. But we went into Mauritius and prepared ourselves, and then went across to Durban to have it properly repaired. So they took all the old, what we patched up, they took off and repaired it. So that was the German. We've since been friendly with the German Raiders Association. They've come over. I've got pictures and things if you want to see them. When we have our annual reunion, they very often come and rejoin with us, and we have been, I haven't been, but some of our chaps have been across to Germany for their annual reunion when they have it. But I've got several pictures of the survivors in England at our meetings and so on, German survivors. We've become friendly again. And That was the Cornwall. Now, do you want to know when she got sunk? How?
Yes, please.
Well, we carried on doing our normal business after this, of course, once we had been repaired. We carried on doing our routine, running around the Cape and up to Aden and back again, looking for German raiders and going back again. We went to, by this time, I think Tobruk had fallen and the Middle East was getting a bit messy. And the Australians were getting out. The Japanese had come into the war and the Australians were being sent home. So we were picking up troops from Aden and bringing them down to Australia. We escorted the Queen Mary and what's the, not the Queen, Queen Mary, we had Queen Mary and somebody else back to Australia, and we dumped all the Australians back from where we left them. We got back to Colombo, and to our amazement, we had a fleet. Now, we had been just odd cruisers in the Indian Ocean, just odd cruisers running around for 2 or 3 years. But all of a sudden, we had battleships, destroyers, aircraft carriers, the lot. I think there were 5 battleships, 2 or 3 aircraft carriers, a couple of squadrons of destroyers. And we all went to sea to look for the Japanese, because apparently they had a report that the Japanese force, in the mean, before this, the Repulse and Prince of Wales had been sunk in Singapore. We in fact had some survivors from the Repulse on board. But we went to sea with the fleet, with this huge fleet we got, searching all around Colombo for the German, for the Italians, for the Japanese. But we didn't find any, and the planes that were still searching still didn't report any. So we came back into Colombo. Are you ready?
Yes.
We came into Colombo. The rest of the fleet went back. We didn't find the Japanese, so the rest of the fleet went down to what we know was known as Port T. Port T was the Maldive Islands. We had created an anchorage there earlier in the war by blasting away the coral. We didn't know it was what it was for, but we had done this job earlier in one of our earlier trips. And the rest of the fleet went to Port T. We went into Colombo. We got there, I think, about 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And my chum and I, Bert Jackson, went ashore about 5 o'clock, and we hadn't got any further than the police sergeant's mess in the dockyard for our first pint, or first half a pint, or whatever it was, first bottle of beer. When we had a recall, they phoned up and said, ships, we've got to recall the crews, anybody ashore got to go back to the ship. So we were back to the ship again. We got there about, 10 minutes late, a quarter hour later. And people were coming back on board all the evening with the race team to go to see it. We were supposed to go to see it the first of all, 8 o'clock. Then it was changed to 10 o'clock. We didn't, in fact, leave harbour until about 12 o'clock because the Dorsetshire, who'd been having a refit, was delayed. So we didn't actually leave harbour until about 12 o'clock. This is Easter Saturday. We were due to go and rejoin the fleet down in the Maldives. So we steamed out of Colombo Harbour about just before midnight. Fairly high speed, about 20 odd knots, which eventually, 8 o'clock in the morning, we went to action stations. And by this time I was a senior chief aboard the ship. So my action station was in the engine room. And so 8 o'clock we went to action stations. We'd had dawn actions before that, but that was just every morning we had dawn action. But this was action stations proper. And apparently there was a plane following us. Something reported that a plane was shadowing us. A Japanese plane. And we carried on steaming down towards the Maldives, put up speed to 27 knots later on. And at 12 o'clock, when I was due to be 4 hours, the watch was finished normally. Because we were at action stations, we had to carry on. So we carried on down below for 5 hours. Still, mind you, we were all wet through. We sweat down below at the time. It's in the tropics, doing high speed. And at 1 o'clock, my chum came down to relieve me with a relief watch, because we had to have something to eat and we wanted to pee anyway. And so he came down to relieve us for an hour. And we had a corned beef sandwich and a cup of tea. And I said, well, we'll go on the upper deck and have a blow. So we went on the upper deck, on the boat deck actually, on the port side, just over the after engine room, and laid out on the deck. We were doing high speed, so it was a nice breeze. We all laid out on the deck and let the breeze blow over us and get nice and cool. I kicked my shoes off, because you only have shoes on when you're in the engine room. You don't have socks or anything, it's sweaty. And we laid there, and it was about 10 to 2, and I looked at my watch and I said, another 10 minutes and we'll go back down below then, take over the watch again. And just at that, well, within a few seconds, there was a terrific wall of water came up right alongside us, and we heard a roar of a plane we didn't hear the plane coming, didn't hear the bomb dropping, but the plane had dived down on us almost vertically, right alongside us, dropped in the sea right alongside the after engine room. The bomb must have burst into the engine room, because they flooded and nobody got out of it. But we all dashed up to go down below. I got on the ladder, and halfway down I realised I hadn't got any shoes on. You can't go in without the shoes on. So I had to fight my way back up again against the people coming down, slipped my shoes on, went down again to the engine room. And I just got to the top of the hatch of the engine room, and the rest of them were just going, they'd all been going down, when whoosh, steam and hot air came rushing up the forward engine room. That had been hit on the starboard side. So the after engine room was the first bomb. It was quite definitely was the first bomb. There was no doubt about that. If you don't get two bombs, the first bomb hit the after engine room on the port side. The official report says it was starboard forward. But it wasn't. It was the port side aft, where the after engine room is. I got on top of the ladder, and up came all this steam and smoke. And I thought, oh, God, she's been hit down below. There's already two watches down there. There's no point in going. Well, there's no point in me trying to go down, because I should have stopped them from coming up. If you're on a single iron ladder, you're just trying to go down. So I thought, well, I'll go and see what's happening elsewhere. I'll go and see what's happened to the after engine room. Went to the after engine room, and there was no sign of any life at all, just water swishing about. So I came back to the forward engine room, and there was nobody there. No, I shouted, anybody there? No, nobody down below. They'd all come out in the meantime, apparently. So what do I do now? There's nobody in the forward engine room, there's nobody in the after engine room. So I went down below to the main switchboard room, because next to the main switchboard room is the magazine. And I always remember that when I was a young ERA, when you are down below in a magazine waiting to flood it, I used to think, my God, what happens if a bomb drops on you? You can't get, you're right down at the bottom of the ship. Nobody will tell you to get out. You've got to stop and flood it. So I thought, well, the ship's not going to... So I bawled down the hatch to this chap, who was this youngster who was down there. Come on up. He said, I can't. I go, well, I've got to flood it. I said, no, you haven't. If any more bombs, and I said, it'll flood itself, because the main switchboard had been hit, and that was flooded too. So I got him out, and I went aft again to the after magazine to look for one. And nobody down there. He must have got out. By this time, apparently, the order of the manship had been given, and I hadn't heard it. So I went on the upper deck, and there was nobody about, but there was a guns crew still firing, and I watched one plane come down and drop a ventilate bomb right on this guns crew. Oh, my God. What do you do now? So I went down below and looked in the mess to see if there was anybody in the mess that had to be got out. No, there was nobody anywhere. I didn't see a soul. And then I thought, well, what do we do now? I don't know what to do next. but there's nobody around. So I went back on the upper deck and somebody said, "Abandoned ship." I said, "Well," so I looked, and there was nobody. I didn't, apart from this one chap who told me to abandon ship, I couldn't see anybody. So the ship was listing by this time, listing to port heavily. I thought, well, if I go on the port side, the ship's going to come over on top of me. So I'm not going that side, that's not very wise. I'd better go over the starboard side. But because the starboard side was listing so much, there was no way I could have jumped from here and got into the water without hitting the ship as I went down. So I thought, well, I'd better find some way of climbing down. And I found a rope, somebody had tied a heaving line to the card rails, and it was hanging over the side, just what I wanted. So I climbed over the side and walked down the side on this rope. And when I got to the, if I dive into the oil, because there was a lot of oil everywhere, I don't want to get covered in oil over my face if I can help it, I'll just walk into the water and swim away. And as I got to the, when I got to the water, I was right alongside the screw that was turning round, still going, of course. But I luckily saw it and pushed myself back into the sea and swam away. The first person I saw was a three-badge stoker who had been a messman of ours, and he got a ship's life belt, you know, the HMS Cornwall life belt, and he got it wearing it. He said, "I can't swim." I said, "Well, you're doing all right, mate." Anyway, I towed him. I said, "I'll give you a tow." I hadn't got the life belt on myself, of course. I told you, I still couldn't see anybody in the water. It seemed strange. Where's everybody got to? Because when you're in the water, you can't see very far. But the ship was only just over here and still going along and getting lower and lower in the water. And eventually I watched it go down. It was probably about a minute, really. And we swam about and we found a cabin door. We tried to get on that to float, but we couldn't balance it. It kept falling off it. Eventually I towed him until we found two or three other people, and they were all swimming towards what we could see. There was a motorboat and a whaler, and we eventually all got together round this motorboat and whaler, and there we stayed. And there were six Carly rafts, so we hung onto the side of the Carly rafts. And there we stopped. We spent the rest of the day. A plane came over late in the afternoon, and we thought, "Oh, that's good," because we were only 2 hours from our rendezvous, as we thought, with the fleet. So we thought we weren't worried about we'll get picked up any minute now. But we didn't. The plane came over and signaled to us, but nothing happened that night. We spent the night, it got cold during the night, and people were dying all the time in the water, and we pushed them away, let them float away. I think we were all wondering about sharks, because we knew it was a shark infested area, but nobody said anything, and I didn't say anything. In the morning nobody seemed to have had any shark attacks, so it was all right. Swam around a bit to try and get a bit of warmth. When the sun came up, it got too hot. But anyway, I think it was about 8:30, as far as I can guess, in the water. I was just swimming back to where hanging onto this Carly raft. Couldn't get into it because it was already full, but hanging on the side of it. And I saw a pilot fish about that long coming along. And right behind it, a bloody great shark. Oh, I was thinking about 8 to 10 feet long. Just calmly swimming along, just under the surface, just down there. I said, "Shark!" And everybody, of course, trying to get into the raft, get their legs out of the water. Everybody splashed about, and there was panic. Well, I won't say panic, but there was a lot of splashing about. And then it subsided, and nobody had been taken. The shark had gone, and that was it. And this happened two or three times. Shark appeared, and somebody would say, shark. So what we did, after about two or three occasions of somebody calling shark, we splashed the water with our hands, all together. One, two, three. And it makes a hell of a noise underwater if 300 or 400 people are splashing the water at the same time. And that's what we did for the rest of the day. When anybody shouted shark, we just smacked the water with our hands. And nobody got taken by sharks. They probably had plenty of dead bodies anyway to eat. But we eventually, a plane came over at about 4:30 in the afternoon and said, help is coming. And then for the first time, although in the official report, there are reports of opening tins of corned beef and tins of fruit and serving out rations. I didn't see any rations. I didn't get any rations. I didn't see any being done, but apparently, because I was in the water, I suppose, but those that were in the Kali raft were getting rations served out to them. Tin fruit. Only half an apricot. But anyway, when this plane came over and said, help is coming, I got my first half an apricot. A piece of corned beef about an inch, or half an inch, 3/4 inch cube, and half an apricot. That was very welcome, actually, but it didn't really matter. I wasn't hungry and I wasn't thirsty. I wasn't worried. But that was the first I saw of any rations being served out. And about 6:30, HMS Enterprise and two destroyers, the Paladin and Panther, I think it was, came and picked us up. The Enterprise picked us up, and the Paladin and Panther picked up the court, the Dorsetshire. They were about 2 miles away from us. We couldn't see them from sea level, but we knew they were there because we saw the ship go down. But we knew they must be somewhere over there. And we got picked up about 6:30. I think we were all on board by 7:00. And we steamed into the Maldives. And that's the only time I wasn't frightened that I was in the water. I wasn't frightened when I abandoned the ship. The only time I really got panicky and frightened was on the Enterprise. I'd been down below and had a shower, and they gave us some sausage and mash, a tot of rum. And I went on the upper deck. It was about 8:30 at night. And I was standing leaning against the guardrail, getting a nice cool breath air, and a bugle sounded right alongside me. I thought, the bloody Japs had come back again, they were coming all the action stations. It wasn't, it was closing up the watch. But my guts dropped, I felt my guts drop out. I thought, I really felt frightened when this bugle sounded. I thought, oh my God, they're coming after us. They didn't. Of course, it wasn't. It was all right, but it was only a moment's panic. But it's the only time I've ever felt really frightened.
You said that you disagreed with the official report.
Yeah.
Were there any other ways in which you disagreed with the official report?
Those two things: where the first bomb dropped, and about the rations. The official report says the rations are being served out during the morning and during the afternoon, but I didn't see any.
Did you ever drop off to sleep in the sea?
I don't know whether I did or not. I think I was awake all night, actually. I remember in the middle of the night, I decided to try and get into the Kali raft if possible, because I were getting a bit windy about sharks, and I managed to get in there, and we were all packed together, and because of the weight of it, were up to our necks in water. The Kali Rock was almost underwater, and we were up to our necks in water. And I could hear a little bit of whimpering. And I thought, well, I looked, and there was very little light, there was no moon, but there was a young midshipman. I could see it was a midshipman from his size, and only a young lad, a boy about 15 or 16. And he was having a little whimper, and I said, you know, I patted him on the back, and I said, you'll be all